I'm Anthony Pastore. Welcome to UBS On Air. Today, we are going to tackle a topic that affects almost every one of us. Dementia has affected millions around the world and inevitably has likely had an impact on your family, friends, and loved ones in one way or another. I'm here today with brain health expert Dr. Mark Milstein, who specializes in cutting-edge brain science in dementia and Alzheimer's. He's earned both his PhD in biological chemistry and his Bachelor of Science in molecular, cellular, and developmental biology from UCLA. He's conducted research on topics including genetics, cancer biology, neuroscience, and infectious disease, and his work has been published in multiple scientific journals. He's also a frequent health expert in the media. Dr. Milstein has been a friend to UBS for quite some time now, and we have had the great opportunity to work with him on our advisor recognition council trips, and most recently, throughout the fall, over 2,500 clients tuned into his exclusive virtual presentation for UBS called Keeping the Aging Brain Young. I'm so happy to say that we have Dr. Milstein back here today with me on the podcast to answer some of the most requested questions from that presentation regarding brain health. So first of all, Mark, it's so nice to have you join us. As I mentioned there, you are such a friend to UBS, and our clients, our advisors, our employees, our prospects, they're all so grateful for the information that you've been providing to them over the course of time that you've been working with us. So thanks again for being here, Mark.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to be with UBS. Thank you so much for having me today.
Of course. So, Mark, I know this is meant to be a follow-up to your presentation on keeping the aging brain young. So for those listening that may not have had the opportunity to listen to and watch that presentation, maybe you can give us a quick synopsis of the top 8 surprising things that make a difference in keeping your brain young.
Yes, definitely. So there's actually quite a bit of hope now in our understanding that we can do these things to lower our risk for dementia. And I just wanted to preface it by saying I was reading an article this morning where a new study came out that they surveyed people in the United States, and they found that 4 out of 5 people want to know ways to reduce their risk of dementia, but 70 to 80% of them were not aware of these specific lifestyle factors that do lower the risk of dementia. So I really actually want to thank UBS for having the platform to get this information out to people, because it's so critically important. And those 8 things that we covered are optimizing our sleep, which is when we have that brainwash that we talked about. And sleep is also when we make our memories stronger. The second thing was to be socially engaged, keep learning new things. We want to make new connections in the brain. Every time we learn something new, we make a new connection, and that's where our memories are housed and stored. But we talked about inflammation and keeping it low. We now realize that there's these cells in our brain. We talked about these microglia, that they can attack our healthy brain if inflammation is high. And so we want to take steps to lower inflammation to keep our brain healthy. We talked about stress. Stress is something that, surprisingly, we actually want to embrace little bursts of it. That can be actually quite helpful to keep our brain healthy and young. But the chronic stress that's too much too often can actually shrink our brain and be damaging. So we want to find ways to manage stress. We talked about things like mindfulness, stress management. Then it's so important to be aware of the food that we're eating. We talked about the MIND diet. So the MIND diet has now been shown in multiple studies. Think Mediterranean diet. This type of diet can lower the risk of dementia anywhere from about 35 to 53% based upon how strict people follow it. And that's very important. And then exercise, walking, 30 minutes of walking a day has been shown to significantly lower risk of dementia. People say, oh, is it really walking? But we do see that there's studies that show that there's something about our feet hitting the ground that really sends signals to our heart and our brain to keep them optimal. And then the last two are these underlying conditions, so that diabetes seems like it wouldn't be connected to the brain health, but we realize these conditions are very much linked. So diabetes, if it's untreated, is one of our single greatest risk factors of developing Alzheimer's. So we want to do everything we can to identify and treat diabetes. We have hopeful data that shows that if we effectively treat diabetes, we can bring the risk of Alzheimer's significantly down. And then the last thing is how important it is to take care of our heart. With every beat of our heart, we're fueling our brain, so it's very hard to have a healthy brain without a healthy heart. So those are those 8 surprising steps that really can help lower risk of dementia and Alzheimer's.
Wow, it's incredible. And I think there's a positive tone there to show that it's not just, you don't just throw in the towel and say, well, there's nothing I can do here. You just provided some really, I would say, sometimes simple ideas. So it's really great to start off that way, Mark. Thank you so much. And something else that you talked about in your presentation, you mentioned that people with sleep apnea, this was surprising to me, that they lost their memory 10 years before the general population because of the interruption of sleep. And we had quite a few questions come in on that subject alone. So how do you recognize sleep apnea and how can you treat it?
Yeah, that's a really important point, is we're showing how important sleep in general and sleep apnea is to memory and brain health. So to recognize sleep apnea, the two most common symptoms are either snoring or gasping for breath or having trouble breathing throughout the night. And then the second most common symptom, and really one we don't want to ignore, is that waking up in the morning and feeling exhausted, feeling like, you know, I just didn't get the benefit of my sleep. I don't feel like I was restored in any way. If anyone has either of those two symptoms, the recommendation is to really reach out to a personal physician and mention this and mention the idea that you'd like to be checked for sleep apnea. There's data that shows that 80% of individuals with moderate to severe sleep apnea are going undiagnosed, so we want to really get the word out. The good news is that we have effective treatments for sleep apnea. It depends upon the underlying root cause of the sleep apnea. So in some cases, it's a machine that helps people breathe. There can be devices, dental devices. There can be lifestyle changes that can help sleep apnea as well. But really, the take-home message is that we want to identify it, we want to treat it. And one piece of very hopeful news is that in the last year, there's been a big advance in identifying or diagnosing sleep apnea using home kits. So it's something to discuss with a personal physician, especially in these times where we can do some of these tests from home and they can be reliable. And then we can, if that is the underlying condition, it can be treated.
Yeah. And interestingly, along the lines of sleep, Mark, obviously we've heard many times that a good night's rest is great for overall health. But the definition of a good night's rest is different depending on who you talk to. You might hear, oh, 6 hours is enough, 8 hours is too much. I hear from friends who say, oh, I only sleep 5 hours a night and that's enough for me. I feel great the next day. So what's the right amount to get every night? And, you know, and something else that I ask about a lot is naps. Are they helpful for brain health, or do you need that kind of, you know, 6 to 8 hours of consistent sleep and not waking up and napping and things like that? What are your thoughts there, Mark?
So when it comes to, we'll start with napping. That's really two great questions. Napping can be really helpful. A way to take an effective nap is keep it to about 30 minutes or less. We sleep in this cycle, and the first 30 minutes is what we call light sleep. And if we wake up in light sleep, that's when you feel really good and energized. But if you've ever taken a nap and you feel awful and groggy and, like, you know, that horrible feeling, very likely the nap went too long. But we have quite a bit of data, even some really recent studies that suggest how important a nap can be to help restore our brain and help our energy and really lower risk for things like memory loss. So a nap is something that can be embraced. Not having it too late in the day is important too, because if it's too late in the day, it can interfere with sleep at night. So naps are great. Keep them short. When it comes to the amount of sleep, it's individualized and there's a personal nature to it. But if we look at the general population, somewhere between 7 and 9 hours is what we see as ideal for optimal brain health. Now, there's definitely people that can get less than 7 and they're just fine. Just the key message is that it's a really small percentage of our population. So we want to have people really be honest and with themselves and say, you know, do I really feel great? Is there any issues with my memory or my physical health? And if somebody is getting less than 7 and that's fine, we don't want to stress them out and tell them they need to lay in bed longer and they need more sleep, because there's definitely that small percentage where less than 7 is fine. But for most people, somewhere between 7 and 9 a night is the ideal. More than 9 is actually what we get concerned too. There's such thing as too much sleep. So those are the ranges that are important for the general population.
That's great. That's definitely something to keep in mind. Terrific, Mark. Something else that was a very, very popular question that we received was about over-the-counter drugs and sleep aids, things like melatonin or Benadryl. You know, people take that sometimes when they can't sleep. What kind of long-term effects could these types of drugs perhaps have on the brain? And subsequently, what about prescription drugs for underlying conditions like blood pressure, depression, things like that?
Yeah, those are really important questions. So if we break it down and we go piece by piece there, the melatonin, as we mentioned in the talk, it's no longer recommended by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine as a first line of defense to help people sleep. Melatonin is not regulated by the FDA, so there's concerns about getting what you're actually hoping that you're getting. There could be other things mixed in. We really need more oversight so that people can feel confident that what they're getting in a supplement is actually what is stated on the bottle. Melatonin, there's also a concern that long-term use of it might throw off the brain's ability to make its own melatonin. The caveat there is that if somebody's personal physician feels like they need melatonin, that can be very responsible. We just don't want people running and grabbing it and taking it if they don't need it, or if it's not, it's because we now understand much more about how the brain works and things we talked about in the talk, like using light and dark to optimize our sleep before we turn to these sleep aids. When it comes to the medications, like the allergy medications that make us feel drowsy, the concern there is that we do have quite a few studies now that show that these medications can disrupt something called choline in the brain. And that disruption is critically important because choline is important for memory. These medications also can disrupt what we call that brainwash. So the idea is that taking this information and taking it to their personal physician and saying, you know, we don't want people to go cold turkey if they've been on medications for a long time that are these over-the-counter sleep aids or using these medications that make you feel drowsy to sleep. But having that conversation and saying, you know, I've heard of these new studies. Is there something else I can be using, or how can I get off of these medications? Because we are concerned about these drowsy-inducing medications and how they impact long-term brain health. And then when it comes to prescription drugs, for things like blood pressure, depression, and a wide range of conditions. Really, it's specific to the medication, and we want people to get that personalized care. But the take-home message is that in some cases, these medications are protecting people from memory issues. So, for example, you mentioned blood pressure. Having optimal blood pressure is one of the new risk factors that we're realizing is so important. So if somebody needs that medication, we have to weigh the risk versus the reward. And really go medication by medication. But really a take-home message is that if anyone is on a prescription medication and they notice any signs of brain fog or memory loss or difficulty focusing or with concentration, we want them to report those symptoms right away to the person who prescribed the medication. We don't want to just say, oh, that, you know, maybe that's nothing, because there's ways to change the dose, change the timing of when the dose is taken, because we don't want to have these medicines that are there to help us have any negative impact. So it's difficult to pull them all together into one answer for all of them, but we want to just be aware of any side effects and have that conversation with the person who prescribed them.
Right, and definitely talk to your doctor if there's something that you feel might not be right, whether it's yourself or a loved one. And I also heard, and Mark, maybe you can talk about this a little bit too, maybe it's not just the individual drug that you're on, but might be because it's combined with other prescription medications that you may be on for other things that could also impact the side effects, correct?
Absolutely. So when it's taken, what else is it being taken with food, without food, time of day? So sometimes just a little tweak to a regimen and can be helpful and eliminating some symptoms of brain fog or memory loss. And so always addressing and trying to optimize for the individual is so important.
Right. What about other vitamins? You talked about obviously melatonin, which is a supplement, but there are lots of other vitamins that are out there that are available to the general public. There's herbs, there are different types of supplements. Have there been any that have been proven to keep the brain at its optimum level?
So when we see these studies, they're a bit all over the place. And the problem is that because of the lack of regulation of knowing exactly what's in these vitamins or in these supplements, it's difficult to get a really good scientific study. It's, you know, when one bottle has too much or too little, it's hard for us to get a really good sense. Overall, the take-home message is that there are definitely key vitamins that are important for the brain. The first the most effective that we're seeing is really getting these things from food. So trying to really optimize our diet. There are definitely some individuals that can eat a really optimized diet and they still are deficient in things like vitamin D or certain levels of vitamin B. And so in those cases, really the recommendation now is try to deal with diet first. Once or twice a year, get that blood test. Ask your personal physician to do the screening for any nutritional deficiencies, you know, the general screening that's done in a blood test. If anything is still deficient, then address it with a supplement, because what we don't want to do is just throw a supplement at an issue without knowing an individual's levels, because we actually have data now that shows that, you know, we hear all the news like, oh, vitamin D is so important. It definitely is important, but taking too much of it can actually lead to things like brain fog, or overdoing a calcium supplement can lead to issues as well with memory loss with certain underlying conditions. So the key thing is that these supplements can be used, or these vitamins can be used, but instead of just hearing a headline, oh, you know, everyone needs to take vitamin B, D, we really want to figure out for individuals what they need. One thing to bring up with a physician is in terms of a supplement is curcumin or turmeric, which there are some studies coming out of UCLA which find that if it's a certain type of curcumin, it might be helpful with inflammation. But again, hearing that study, we don't want people to run out and start taking it because it can have some side effects. But if somebody is interested in or needs to have something that can be helpful with inflammation, that is a supplement that has now reached a point where this is something to bring up to your doctor and say, would curcumin or turmeric be something that could be beneficial to me? Would it be worth, would the benefits be worth it for me? And then really talk about the type that can be absorbed, so we're actually getting the benefit from it, because just grabbing any supplement off the shelf oftentimes isn't as beneficial as getting the right one for the right underlying condition.
Right. And a lot of supplements that are on the shelf, from my understanding, is they're not always made out of the best ingredients, or they're combined with things that maybe you don't necessarily want to be taking, like there are plastics in there or different kinds of materials that just end up in the pill. So you got to be really, really careful about where you're getting your vitamins and what you're exactly taking.
Yeah, absolutely. We really need more oversight here. It's a big marketing business, but the science behind it is not as strong as the marketing, and we need people to be safe. And again, if they need certain vitamins, that can be definitely appropriate. We just want to make sure it's the right vitamin for the right individual.
Right. You talked about, Mark, that, you know, that inflammation is something that is a key indicator or a key concern that could potentially cause a lack of brain health. So you want to keep inflammation low and treat any underlying conditions that might cause that inflammation. So what would you say are the most effective ways to, first of all, recognize that and also to reduce it?
So inflammation is, we're learning, so important for our brain health. And so a couple things to be aware of are, we talked about in the presentation, being aware that any injury or autoimmune conditions, these are things that can increase the amount of inflammation. So just being aware that those conditions we want to effectively treat. Ways to recognize inflammation are, there's a blood test now called C-reactive protein. And C-reactive protein is something that is in our blood. So if we think of inflammation like a fire, this is almost like smoke that's released from the fire that we can track, and it gets into the bloodstream. And so the CRP blood test is a really effective way for physicians and patients to be aware if there's any inflammation that is in the blood, can make its way to the brain and do damage. It's now mainstream medicine, but sometimes it can be helpful to ask for it and have that communication with a physician that, you know, I'm concerned about my brain health and I just want to keep track of this number. That number is not the end-all be-all, but it can be informative to be tracking and to be aware of inflammation. And then in terms of reducing inflammation, we want to first look at ways to treat any autoimmune conditions, any sources of inflammation. The good news is we actually really have some really excellent medications. There's been a big jump forward in the last few years in how to treat these underlying conditions, and then lifestyle factors. And what's really hopeful is that the things that we talk about for brain health are essentially the same things that lower inflammation. So optimizing our sleep, every night when we go to sleep, our brain helps rebalance and minimize inflammation. Our stress, so chronic stress releases a stress hormone called cortisol, which can increase inflammation. So mindfulness, taking breaks, managing our stress is another way to lower inflammation. And then the food that we and exercise. So the food that we eat, the things like the Mind diet, Mediterranean diet, and then getting some, you know, exercise that's not too intense, but really gives us a, you know, a little bit of a challenge, but makes us feel energized the next day. All those key components of the things that we talked about, really the eight things on the list, we don't need to do that anymore. It's really just those things that are really helpful for also optimizing inflammation and just being aware of any underlying conditions that need to be effectively treated.
Right. I want to talk about food with you, Dr. Milstein, because it seems to be a big culprit of inflammation. Maybe you can discuss the connection between gut health and the brain.
Yeah, this is really one of the most fascinating areas of brain health, and it's happening in a different part of the body, which is your gut. So in a nutshell, essentially everything we eat ends up in our gut, and we have billions of bacteria waiting there. because most of the food that we eat, we actually can't digest ourselves. Our bacteria is waiting there in the gut to break down and essentially eat and digest the food for us. And certain types of bacteria in the gut will break the food down in a way where it actually lowers inflammation in the gut, which then can leave the gut, get in the bloodstream, and impact the brain. And other types of bacteria in the gut will actually break the food apart in a way that will release inflammation. So it depends upon two key factors. Essentially, the types of food that we eat can determine the types of bacteria in the gut. So foods that are really processed. So I always like to say, like, if you look at your food and on the back, it looks like a chemistry experiment gone wrong. It's just a ton of ingredients that we can't pronounce. Those types of foods end up in our gut and feed the types of bacteria that can increase inflammation. So really a key take-home message is that we want to most of the time just eat food that is whole, natural, not overly processed, doesn't have a lot of additives and preservatives, because what can happen is that that keeps inflammation lower in the gut, which is less inflammation getting into the bloodstream, which is then not making its way to the brain. So we see now, you know, what we're eating has this very powerful connection to our brain health.
We did get a lot of questions about this next topic, which is about caffeine. But, you know, they ask about generally how does caffeine impact the brain? But also they took it to the next level talking about energy drinks and soda. I think we can all pretty much safely say we've heard the negative effects of soda. There really isn't much positive going on there. But just in general, what's your thought on those types of drinks?
Yeah, so definitely when it comes to soda, the amount of sugar that's in them is a concern. That's more sugar than usually than it's going to get into the bloodstream that we should be handling at any given moment. So when it comes to caffeine and energy drinks, the biggest concern is how caffeine impacts our sleep. So some people, caffeine actually doesn't impact their sleep. They can down a cappuccino like 5 minutes before bed and fall right to sleep. They actually have just different brain chemistry than other people. But for most people, cutting off caffeine, especially if you're having trouble sleeping, by about 1 or 2 in the afternoon, because caffeine stays in the body a long time. It has a long half-life. So if you're having trouble sleeping, looking at your caffeine intake and trying to push it back to earlier in the day. When it comes to caffeine, though, actually some studies that came out just in the last couple weeks showed that moderate amounts of caffeine might be helpful in terms of memory. We're not really at the point where we start to recommend caffeine, but if somebody's enjoying coffee and tea in a moderate amount, then there seems to be some benefits there that caffeine has. The caffeine mixed with the coffees and the teas, which have these things called flavonoids in them, those are anti-inflammatory compounds. So it's believed that they might, on one hand, help lower inflammation, and then the caffeine also can be stimulating to the brain and can be helpful in terms of memory. So there's some hopeful news there for people who enjoy coffee and tea, that there might be some benefits there for the brain.
Right. I'm a coffee drinker myself. I hope that all these years of drinking that will certainly help in the future. So I want to go back to exercise with you, because right at the top you mentioned 30 minutes of walking a day is really great type of exercise for the brain. But what are some tips that you could provide for getting exercise if, say, you aren't someone who is into working out, or maybe you can't do intense types of exercises, if it's an older person who might not be as comfortable on their feet? What do you recommend?
Yeah, so this is another one where if you don't want to run a marathon, you don't want to do something super intense, we have a lot of good news. And the good news is that little bits of exercise, just movement every day in little amounts, can make a big impact. And so just to share with you, they took a really interesting study. They took a group of people aged late 60s to late 80s, and they just had them do 4 minutes of walking for four sections. So 4 minutes, a little bit of a break, 4 minutes, a little bit of a break, up to 16 minutes. And what they found was that these were people who are at all different fitness levels, and they just had them give a little bit of a push, so that, you know, if you're walking, maybe between street signs, just give a little bit more of an effort to that walk. And they found that the people who did this little bit more of intensity to their walking, we're not talking about running or anything intense, just a little bit more of a push to it, they actually improved their memory over the study by 30%. So it really is interesting how we're not talking about something overly intense. If that amount is too intense, even the author said, start with just a minute or two and work up. You know, if you can get out and do a minute of walking, 2 minutes, then you can next day move it to 3 minutes, move it to 4 minutes. We just really want to make sure that we're getting that movement in, and we don't need to be striving for anything overly intense. Just just getting that movement is so critically important to the brain, and it doesn't have to be a high threshold.
Right, and I like how you mentioned that the brain, the feet hitting the floor has a positive reaction to the brain. It's fascinating how our body works all together, and I think we don't really think about it that way and maybe even take certain things for granted. So that's something to truly consider when you're thinking about just getting up off the couch or out of bed and, you know, just walk, even if you're walking around your house for a few minutes, it's a great way to just get up and get some exercise. So Mark, you know, we've spoken about the prevention of dementia and Alzheimer's, but what if someone has already been diagnosed? This is something that's actually very personal to me, as I have someone important in my life who was recently diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Are there any studies out there that have had any kind of success in the reversal of memory decline?
Yeah. So first, I'm sorry to hear about your family member, and I definitely wish them the best. In terms of lowering or reducing symptoms, we actually do have some hopeful studies, and they're coming out of places like Cornell. And we're seeing that people who have early stages of memory loss, early stages of dementia, if they start going on a program where they essentially do an intervention, all the things that we've talked about, they optimize their diet, they make sure that they're really treating underlying conditions, they check their CRP levels, they make sure they're optimizing heart health, any issues with diabetes, they keep learning new things, actively learning new things, everything on the list. They're in these studies, and these are early studies, but they're very hopeful that they saw a slowing down of the progression of memory loss versus people who didn't do these things. And so that's really important. We have to be very, we have to be very realistic and say that we can't say that we have anything that we can do where we're going to actually turn back and we're going to change what's happening in the brain. But the symptoms, we believe we have studies that show that they can slow it down. And so the hopeful news is that while we have these lifestyle interventions, we believe that even if we can catch things early, we can slow things down. And that's really another key point, is that we want to be aware that catching things early is not something we want to be afraid of, but something we want to be aware of, because the earlier we can detect things, we believe the earlier the intervention, the more powerful this can be to slow down. And just a hopeful news on the horizon is that there's actually blood tests that are going to be available soon in doctors' offices. There's just something recently approved, that blood tests that can of early stages of dementia, specifically Alzheimer's disease, and then we can get on top of these things as soon as possible and hopefully slow down that progression.
Wow, that's an exciting progression in the diagnosis, because I know in the past it's very difficult to diagnose, you know, specifically, or you have to go through all the mind tests, and they do different kinds of blood work, but there's never been a definitive way to say whether or not it's Alzheimer's. So that's a very exciting advancement. You know, the last question for you today is about the latest research, kind of touched on it a little bit, but maybe you can share with us some of the latest research that's coming out that you've discovered over the last few months on brain health that could be helpful to our listeners.
Yes, yeah, so I'm very hopeful and optimistic. Just in the last 6 months, there has been some really fascinating studies that have looked at essentially a lot of studies that we call these meta-analyses, and they found that whereas we were saying that there was, you know, 8 to 10 things that we really can do, we're now starting to expand that number. And we're starting to see that there are things beyond this list. We're up to about almost 18 things that we can do that are offshoots of these 8 things that we were talking about. And the more things that we have that are actionable, we're really excited about. And so some of these things are very much related to heart health. And so what we're learning is that what's happening in our heart is really important for what's happening in our brain. And so things, for example, like being aware of blood pressure and even being aware of low blood pressure. So there's something, an issue where something that can easily be ignored and say, oh, you know, maybe is that really a big deal? If somebody gets up from a seated position or a lying down position and they feel lightheaded, that's a condition where we now realize that raises the risk of memory loss, because it's low blood pressure. It's not allowing the blood to essentially get to the brain and keep the brain fueled. And so the connection point here is that if we have individuals, if we get this information out to people, and we don't want them to be, you know, worried about this, but if they get out and we have effective treatments for low blood pressure. So it's just one example where we say, oh, we see a warning sign, we have an effective treatment for it, and now this is something that we can help lower the risk for the population, because this is something that we can help curtail and help, you know, head this off before it gets worse and might progress into something that can lead to damage in the brain. So I'm actually working on a next phase of this presentation where we really put together these next things like the low blood pressure, understanding other aspects of our heart health. And one other thing, a study came out just a couple of days ago that found that our outlook, you know, sometimes we can ignore these things and we don't tend to think about them, but they found that people who had a positive outlook about the future and about the present were less likely to suffer from memory issues. Mm. And so sometimes, you know, we can easily, you know, roll our eyes at those studies and we say, how scientific is this? But if we actually put the pieces together, we realize that being positive, being happiness, the scientific aspect of that is that's changing the amount of cortisol and stress hormone in our body, which changes the amount of inflammation, which has an impact on the brain. So we realize that our thoughts and our mindset can also play a part in this complex puzzle. And so having that as in our toolkit can be important too. So overall, I'm very optimistic about all this new research, plus what I spoke about earlier in terms of new ways to diagnose, new ways to catch things early, and having these lifestyle interventions as early as possible.
That's so encouraging, Mark. It's so nice to end our conversation on a really positive note, to see that there's so much research being done and new studies being conducted. And I love the idea of, you know, feeling, having happy thoughts. I think, you know, as you said, people might be rolling their eyes at that, but it does, you know, you can feel the change in yourself when you've reached that positivity level. They always say laughter is the best medicine. I bet in this case, it's not so far off.
Yeah, very true. It's interesting how much the mind is connected to our overall health, and it does play a role.
Well, Mark, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for being with us today. And it sounds like there are so many exciting things that are happening that by the time we get you back in 2021, you'll have a whole new series of questions that'll come your way and new information for us. So we would love to have you come back and join us again, because honestly, these tips are really life-changing for every one of us and our loved ones, whether it's something that is impacting a family member or a loved one or a friend or ourselves directly. There's such great information that you shared with us, and we learned so much from you and your research. So thank you for connecting with UBS again, and thanks for joining me on the podcast, Dr. Milstein. Great to be with you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for having me, and it's always a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate it.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that clients understand the ways in which we conduct business, that they carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide to them about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review the PDF document at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG, member FINRA SIPC.